You're tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk drug policy reform and what last week's vote to decriminalize magic mushrooms in D.C. means for locals. But first, we're talking about the film Residue, which tells the story of Jay, a D.C. native who moves back to the district after film school. He discovers his northeast neighborhood, Eckington, has changed dramatically. The film deals with identity, racism, and gentrification in our ever-changing city. And joining us now to talk about it is Marawi Jerima. He is the writer and director of the recently released film. Welcome, Marawi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit more about your film and its protagonist, Jay.
You said it best. Basically, Jay is somebody who's coming home with great intentions to, you know, tell the story of how he grew up and his childhood. But when he comes back, basically, you know, the neighborhood's gone and his childhood friends are scattered, you know, left and right. So he's just trying to figure out, one, what happened, but two, like, you know, what does he do now in this new city?
We have a clip to play from Residue. It's a voiceover monologue we hear from the protagonist, Jay, at the beginning of the film as he makes his journey cross-country from film school in L.A. back to Eckington in D.C. It's the voices he hears essentially in his head asking him, why are you coming back to D.C., Jay? Here it is.
Did you sense that our obliteration was right around the corner? You brought the only weapon that you had, a camera. Who you about to shoot, Jay? Did you actually think a script could make a difference? You thought a film could save us? Or did you see yourself as an archaeologist coming to unearth our bones from the concrete?
That was from the film Residue. Marawi, are these fears and memories that went through Jay's head something you wondered as well when embarking on making this film?
I mean, yeah, no question. You know, this thing was a totally personal endeavor. First, I'd like to say, though, that voiceover is not really what he's hearing in his head. In my mind, it's if one of his lost friends could speak, you know, that's kind of what they would be saying, you know.
Okay, gotcha.
Kind of seeing his efforts, you know, to fix things, you know, as best he can. But to me, the film comes directly out of my experience. I think there was a point where I was trying, you know, to not let it be so, you know, to really kind of create this, you know, kind of fictional account, you know, and imagine something different. But every time, you know, I put pen to paper, it's really just my memories, the mythology of my neighborhood, the stories I heard coming up. Those are the type of things that just kind of came directly to the forefront.
Marawi, did you see this film as a form of activism, and did that change at any point?
You know, I mean, certainly it came out of a desire to kind of jump into the fray regarding, you know, this kind of cultural battleground that's happening right now in the city with the eradication mm-hmm. of Black people's culture. But I think, you know, more central than that is kind of the desire I think I have to kind of make sense of the totally different trajectory that my life has taken as compared to the people I grew up with, you know. And so that's kind of the heart of the story is him looking for, you know, Demetrius.
Marawi, this film ended up being autobiographical to an extent, but at first, it's my understanding you did not want to admit that, right? Why was that? And how did you end up opening up about it?
Well, you know, I mean, as artists, I think that's the knee-jerk reaction, or that's the way that we set out, or maybe we're taught to, or whatever, just to kind of, you know, maybe personally invest a piece of art. But you know, at a certain point, we try to disconnect ourselves from it, you know, and I think that that's kind of a process of protecting ourselves, you know, because mm-hmm. to say this film was about me, this character, you know, is feeling things that I felt, you know, you open yourself up to, you know, kind of having to account for all your insecurities that are on display, all your fears, all these, you know, maybe possibly embarrassing things. But, you know, I think once I kind of overcame that kind of barrier and just let it, you know, just allowed it to be as about me as it was trying, you know, I think it was a very freeing experience, you know, where I could just kind of, you know, really explore things that had been, you know, kind of nagging me for years up to this point.
So how much of the story is yours, and how is your story in some ways maybe different from Jay's?
You know, I mean, I'm a filmmaker. I came back to my childhood, you know, neighborhood, trying to tell a story about my neighborhood, you know, to find it completely eradicated. You know, so in many ways, that's, you know, my life is the premise. But, you know, I think that in the creation of the film, I was allowed to take it far and beyond what my own, you know, kind of physical life would allow. You know, Jay does many things that I myself wouldn't do. But at the same time, there are things that I totally understand, you know, and totally think, you know, is important for people to have the ability to do and to express, you know, for example, just how angry he is in the film. To me, it's an emotion that is difficult for me to access after, you know, 30 years of growing up in kind of a racist country that doesn't allow black people to, you know, or that, you know, frowns upon black anger. You know, it's the last thing anybody wants in this country. But in the end, you know, something that I think black people should be able to access, you know, just as wholesomely as anybody else. You know, even a life lived with every emotion other than anger is not really a life fully lived. And I think at the end of the day, you know, we suffer from suppressing that. And so I think it's an important, it was an important exercise for me to kind of put that on the screen.
We're talking with Marawi Jurima. He is the writer and director of the recently released film Residue. And here now is Charles in Southeast Washington. Charles, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. How are everybody out there doing on Radio Land? I just like to say gentrification of Atkinson, of neighborhoods that black people have lived in, I see that taking place in small southern towns like Asheville, North Carolina, Huntsville, Alabama, and they've been gentrified too. And I was talking to some people, and I've been moved around from black neighborhoods, they're being moved around, and they're taking people who are in the same plight, black and white, and the politicians are pitting them against each other. But some of the same things that had happened in my neighborhood with drugs and death and suicide is taking place in the neighborhood of these Southerners, and they become Trumpers or Republicans who are against something. And I look to where we can bridge a gap between separation from each other as human beings and understand the class system that has been put in place here in America that black people have been under ever since we've been here.
Well, I do have to say that the film Residue does not go into electoral politics at all. But given that Charles has been talking about what he sees going on in other parts of the country, Marawi, do you believe that one of the reasons that this film has been so widely acclaimed is because it has nationwide and maybe even worldwide significance?
I mean, yeah, you know, I hope so. You know, my hope is that it's taken up just as strongly in Oakland, you know, in Brooklyn as it has been in D.C., you know. And I think that, like, the idea behind that is that, you know, by and large, you know, the cultural kind of destruction, which kind of erupts, you know, from gentrification is something that is, it points to every other aspect of it that we, you know, it shines a great light and unifying kind of light and connecting gentrification to all the other things that, you know, kind of come out of it. So, for example, to me, you know, the film goes to great lengths to connect gentrification to police brutality, to say that they're similar, you know, to say that our experiences right now in this moment under the, you know, kind of racist kind of police oppression, which we're seeing, it's all tied together. And so I think that, like, in many ways, it is easily kind of applicable to so many black people's situations all over the world.
You know, many of the actors in this film, from main characters to extras, were not professionals, and many were from the D.C. area as well. Why I found that amazing is that when I watched the film, I have friends who lived in the unit block of Q Street and who only moved maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And when I saw the guys who were sitting on that stoop, I could have sworn that I knew them, that I had seen them before. So tell us about the casting process.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. Like, those are my neighbors. Those are the old heads, you know. They were old heads when I was growing up, and now they still there, you know, fortunately able to survive through, you know, up until now. Like, so the goal from the outset was to say, you know, we want a project. Really, it's an excuse to get as many people on camera, you know, to document the neighborhood before it was too late. So for me, you know, it only made sense that everybody I knew would act in it. All the locations are locations from my life, you know, my community, to really pack it in, you know, so that later down the line, who knows what will happen, we can at least say that there's a record of our existence. And so, you know, with that as a starting point, you know, it was really only, it's only natural that you know, you kind of get that feeling watching the film, that because it really is. It's just mostly, primarily non-actors, people who I know, family, friends. That was the casting process. Word of mouth, you know. Very few people who were casting the film I didn't know beforehand.
What about casting the child actors who play the younger versions of the main characters?
Yeah, you know, for example, Jakari Dye is the young boy who plays the younger version of the main character. And that is the son. At the time, he was 7 years old. That's the son of one of my best friends growing up, you know. And to arrive in the neighborhood, to see him still there, at a time when we're trying to cast this film, where he can act really and play his parents' generation. To me, it was the most, you know what I mean, the most healing, kind of fulfilling process, just the production of the film itself, just kind of the organic way that we went about doing it. It doesn't stop with him. All the boys in the film, all the kids are from Q Street. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, no, so I was right. I actually did recognize some of those people from that neighborhood. Yeah. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Marawi Jerima. He's the writer and director of the recently released film Residue. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. Our guest is Marawi Jerima. He's the writer and director of the recently released film Residue. Marawi, you make a very interesting choice in the film. I was going to ask you about the juxtaposition in the film of gentrifiers and locals, and why you decided to present the gentrifiers as a group of anonymous entities, but I'm going to have Ben in Washington ask the question in his own way. Ben, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much. And also, Marawi, thank you so much for bringing this story to the collective consciousness. Yeah, I just wanted to understand a little bit more about your stylistic approach. Initially, the white characters were kind of amorphous in the initial scenes of the film. They didn't have faces, and it seems to be an interesting kind of paradox where oftentimes, being black in D.C., you walk around feeling like you don't have a face. So I'd love to hear more about that approach and why that was important in a film.
Marawi?
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you. Yeah, man. Well, first and foremost, it was a kind of an economic or kind of the situation that we were in. We couldn't find enough white people to be in the film. You know, at any stage during this 2 years of shooting, we were struggling really to find white folks to act in it. And so in that first scene when the guy tells him to turn his music down, we actually needed that actor. We needed his face to be the guy across the street when Jay goes and knocks on the door, expecting his friend to open, but it's this white dude. So we couldn't show his face in that first moment. And so, you know, kind of when we had that was the first day of shooting. And when that option revealed itself, that we didn't have to show people's faces, which goes against, you know, your instincts as a filmmaker. Once we kind of broke through that barrier, we were like, yo, like, this is actually amazing. You know, what an incredible opportunity to exercise our power, you know, as filmmakers. You know, we have no power in the city. We really cannot stop gentrification, you know, in a true sense, you know. But we have all the power within the frame of our film. And so why not push white folks to the edges, you know, to just be a presence, just like the police, you know, just like every other oppression that Black people face. We don't really, you know, experience them on an individual basis, you know what I mean? The way gentrifying white folks come in, like, we experience them, you know, tied in, like I said, with everything else. And so we just felt it was such an opportune moment to express that visually, you know. But also, you know, if you look at Jay and what he's focused on, you know, from a story perspective, you know, he's focused totally 100% on the people who have survived up to this point. He's looking for who has went where, who's been locked up, who's still alive, you know. And so he's not thinking about really anybody else. And so even just from that perspective, it just made so much sense to just, you know, keep the camera on his shoulder and focus on the people he's focused on.
Ben, thank you very much for your call. On now to Mona in Washington, D.C. Mona, your turn.
Hello. I want to congratulate Merawi. It's very exciting what young people are doing and being able to tell stories that have previously not been told. But I also want to make mention that Merawi comes from very great DNA film stock. I was introduced to his family through his father, Professor Garima from Howard University's Sankofa film. So if you want more from the family, look up his father too. And thank you again for the film.
Thank you very much for your call, Mona. I have known Merawi's parents for more than, known and respected them for more than four decades. For more, for those who don't know, as Mona said, your father, Haile Gerima, is an acclaimed filmmaker whose films, including Teza and Sankofa, have won major awards at international film festivals. Your mother, Shurikiana, is a filmmaker and producer in her own right, and she's worked on her own projects as well as with your father. Tell us more about your parents and how they influenced you.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch any one of their films, my film will make more sense. Hello?
Yep, I'm hearing you.
Oh, sorry. I was saying, if you watch any one of their films, my films will gain greater context. You know, my mother, she created a film called Brick by Brick back in the 70s, you know, about gentrification or what they call displacement back then. You know, and so everything I do comes directly out of, you know, that experience of growing up with these two incredible Black independent filmmakers.
Your mother briefly appears in the film as well, in a very moving and powerful scene, well, actually two scenes. Tell us about that moment and how she ended up making an appearance.
Yeah, sure. It's a delay, so I'm gonna shoot it out there. Basically, you know, my mother was not supposed to be in the film at all. She was on set that day, you know, when actually the woman who was supposed to play that role, she actually was a no-show. And so, you know, when we found out, I saw my mother, who was on set, just kind of helping my sister, you know, cater, you know, for the crew. She was bringing food, and she kind of happened to look like the character. So I was like, Ma, you know, we need you. Can you do this? And we had no time, really. She was kind of put on the spot immediately. And she didn't want to do it at first, not because she's shy or nervous or anything, but because this history of the neighborhood, you know, and these stories, especially that moment with Mike, that character specifically, is something that she has experienced. She was in the neighborhood, you know, many years before I was born, you know, with my dad helping to raise these kids who would grow up, you know, the generation before me, who would grow up to be just totally cut down by, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic, police, you know, war on crime, everything that, you know, Black people experienced in D.C. in the 90s. And so for her, it's very real. And she's not acting in that moment, you know, and I think that she happened to be there and we were blessed, but that was the type of production we were running where it was very just like, you know, moment to moment. But God bless her.
And for those who don't know about Sankofa, that's the cafe and bookstore on Georgia Avenue, launched and run by Merawi's parents. It focuses on Pan-African literature, film, and culture and hosts a range of events. Merawi, how do your parents feel about your film residue?
I mean, they're proud, you know, they're very happy. I think they were there through the whole process, you know, in production, kind of, you know, on the sidelines, you know, not really hands on. But while I was editing the film, it was so critical to be able to show them, you know, different versions and get their feedback. You know, they're very, you know, critical feedback, which is what you need and want as a filmmaker. But now, you know, I'm kind of just, you know, using everything that they've built as a launch pad to really kind of go and kind of, you know, continue this kind of Garima tradition of filmmaking. I think that they, you know, they're very proud of kind of, you know, this spaceship which they've built, you know.
Here's Chris in Rockville, Maryland. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to field my question. So I'm a young professional, white male in his 20s, and I love D.C. I live there now. And my question is, what is a way to responsibly, you know, become part of the community without eradicating that culture that's there? You know, I want to make sure that, you know, part of the reason we all come to D.C. is because of that culture that you're really discussing. And I want to make sure that, you know, while living in the city, we're not out there destroying it and gentrifying and really, you know, supporting and uplifting a lot of those ideals in the culture that you really speak about in your film.
Marawi, how would you respond?
Well, you know, one, I don't take too much time to, you know, kind of answer these questions, because there's people who could probably help you so much better than me, but also, you know, my focus is elsewhere. But I'll say, at a certain point, you do have to ask how, though, you know, well-meaning as you are, how is it that, you know, just in the regular day-to-day pursuit of your own happiness, you've been weaponized against Black people at every turn? You know, even just by going to get your coffee, you know, you're, you know, the convenience of that comes at the cost, at great cost. And so I think once you start asking those questions, maybe you'll be able to start getting to some answers that'll work for you and the people around you.
Almost out of time, but what's next for you, Marawi, and where else do you see local filmmaking going?
Man, you know, I really hope that, you know, I've been, a lot of young creatives, you know, from the city have been reaching out to me, and I give as much time as I possibly can to advise them through this. But like, to me, the path forward for young black, you know, creatives and filmmakers with something that they want to say is to just get up and do it. You know, our whole mantra through the project was green light yourself, because we had no money, you know, nobody coming to help or save us. And so I think that, like, the more that black film creatives in the city or artists in the city kind of take up that same kind of idea of just going forward, you know, despite, you know, under all conditions, I think that's the way to go.
Marawi Jareem is the writer and director of the recently released film Residue. Marawi, thank you for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
When we come back, we'll talk drug policy reform and what last week's vote to decriminalize magic mushrooms in D.C. means for locals. I'm Kojo Namli.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.